This is The Guardian.
Regid Ahmed here on Gadigal land with a full story.
This was our last best chance to strike what we're doing right now and eliminate the intolerable threats posed by this sick and sinister regime. And they are indeed sick and sinister. Our objectives are clear.
Since U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to join Israel in a war on Iran, the world has been asking why and what's the plan? As the lack of clarity and confusion has grown, so has the conflict, dramatically expanding across the region. But what is Donald Trump's ultimate goal? Does he have one? And how do the American public and politicians view this new war by a president who promised he was against this sort of conflict? Today, Washington Bureau Chief David Smith on how long this could all go on for and what's really motivating Donald Trump. It's Tuesday, the 3rd of March. Hi, David. Thank you for joining us after another very busy day in Washington, D.C.
Great to be here, Richard. Thanks.
It's days into the war, and Donald Trump has finally given his first live remarks. His critics have been demanding that he spell out a vision for this war. Did he give any sufficient rationale for why he's done this?
Yeah, Donald Trump spoke at the White House on Monday.
Let me provide a brief update on Operation Epic Fury. Today, the United States military...
He did at least attempt to offer an explanation of why the U.S. has attacked Iran and why now.
Never going to have a nuclear weapon. I said that from the beginning. They're never going to have a nuclear weapon. They were on the road to getting one legitimately.
Obviously, a big part of that was Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons, which Trump claimed could come about sooner rather than later if there was not intervention. And of course, we saw those negotiations break down ultimately last week. Trump also suggested that Iran had a comprehensive ballistic missile program, and that was a way to potentially shield its nuclear efforts and put everyone in the region in jeopardy.
The regime already had missiles capable of hitting Europe and our bases, both local and overseas, and would soon have had missiles capable of reaching our beautiful America.
Somewhat speculatively, Trump talked about how these missiles could one day threaten America, and there's not much evidence for that, and I think most experts are pretty skeptical of Iran being able to attack the U.S. in such a way, but that was at least some of his argument. And of course, he also talked about Iran as a state sponsor of terrorism, backing proxy groups in the region, and the need to curtail that.
He was also still very much Donald Trump. He got a little bit distracted by his new ballroom.
That was bizarre. There was some construction work audibly going on nearby. Trump was speaking in the East Room.
Thank you, everybody. We have a lot of great service members here with us, too, in this beautiful building. Isn't it beautiful? We're adding on to the building a little.
Yeah, a very strange pivot where at one moment he's talking about America's war dead and the sacrifice they're making and why it's therefore necessary to press on with this mission. And then almost in the next breath, touting this wonderful, glamorous ballroom.
And there's your entrance to it right there. In fact, it looks so nice, I think I'll save money on the doors because it can't get more beautiful than that. I picked those drapes in my first term. I always like gold.
That's going to be adjoining the White House and how it's under budget and on schedule. And, you know, he was sort of looking at the drapes and so on. Very weird, I think, to be in that room and witness that. But oddly, I do see a connection there in that Trump regards himself as the guy to get things done and not go through the normal channels, not bother with committees and building consensus. And that applies to the trivial things like demolishing the White House East Wing without consulting Congress or planners. And it also applies to the big things like bombing a foreign country, potentially triggering a huge regional war without even bothering to, again, consult Congress or the United Nations. Trump seems convinced of his divine mission in all of this.
Going through the normal channels, he's a pretty norm-breaking president. I mean, how extraordinary is it for an American president to go to war without making a case to the American people? You would have expected press conferences and conversations much earlier than this.
That's right. I mean, in the 1940s, after Pearl Harbor, Franklin Roosevelt addressed a joint session of Congress and talked about this is a day that will live in infamy. And throughout history, there's at least been the appearance of consultation, although some would argue presidents have exerted more and more executive authority. A striking example, of course, was President George W. Bush after 9/11, building up to the Iraq War. He did at least go through the motions of a vote in Congress that was hugely controversial. His team gave a presentation to the UN. He worked to build a big international coalition, famously standing with Tony Blair of the UK. All of that. Now, you could argue, what was it all for when Bush's argument about weapons of mass destruction was built on falsehoods and collapsed? But certainly, it's undeniable Donald Trump is going about it a very different way. He's barely bothered to make a case. And at his State of the Union address last week, Iran didn't come up until well into the second hour. There was very little information for Congress. And there was a sense of America sleepwalking into this war. He did not really try to persuade the public of the need for this. They just woke up one morning and discovered American bombs were flying.
I do very much want to get into the public reaction that you've seen, but what a lot of people want to know around the globe is how long this could go on for. Did we get clarity from the Trump administration on that?
Yeah, I mean, Trump speaking in the White House said that they had originally projected, I think it was 4 weeks, but they were capable of going much longer if necessary. And all the indications have been that it remains very fluid. I think the original White House and Pentagon projection was based on the idea that it would take much longer to wipe out the top leadership of the Islamic regime, the Ayatollah Khamenei, who, of course, was killed on Saturday, and others. Trump himself said they're way ahead of schedule there, with dozens of them killed already. I think he'll be monitoring, you know, what other progress is made. Very hard to know, very hard to estimate, so unpredictable at the moment as nearly a dozen countries in that region are drawn in as Iran retaliates. We've also seen Israel attacking Hezbollah in Lebanon. It's clearly a hugely volatile situation. But I think one thing that Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance would argue so far is that they are not intending to turn this into one of the so-called forever wars like Afghanistan and Iraq, because right now, there is no indication of U.S. boots on the ground for any significant period of time. And therefore, that leaves the option open to turn around and leave when they want.
Donald Trump said ahead of schedule, as you say, it suggests that there is a schedule. One of the other questions and conversations around this is whether America and Israel intend to effect regime change. Given Trump speaking, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth as well, did we get a sense? Did they say and confirm whether that is their intention?
They don't appear to be using that phrase. I mean, certainly on Saturday, when Trump first announced these military strikes in a video released at 2:30 a.m. from Mar-a-Lago, released on Trump's own social media site, Truth Social, you know, all very on brand for him. I think the biggest surprise was right at the end of that address, where he said it's now up to the Iranian people to effectively rise up, to take control of your country. You know, you've not had an opportunity like this for decades. It's the best opportunity for generations. That was essentially a call for regime change, I think. And there's not much he and others have said since then to contradict that. But one of his allies, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, articulated some of it on the Sunday Politics shows, and he was drawing a distinction that, yes, this is very important for America's security interests to get rid of that regime after 47 years. It's the biggest state sponsor of terrorism in the region. But then it's over to the Iranian people, and he said, it's not up to us to do nation building, and an echo there, of course, of Bush in Iraq. you know, it's not up to us to choose the next leader or dictate terms. That's up to the Iranian people. So yes, I mean, there does seem to be this idea of regime change. How you define that is a question. You know, how many leaders in the regime do you have to kill for it to constitute change? But it doesn't sound like they're intending to sort of see it through in this idea of America planting a democracy in the Middle East.
Right, it's Monday night in D.C. Americans have had a few days to process this new war. What is the overwhelming reaction from the public?
You know, I think it's interestingly complicated. I think there's some polls showing that a majority oppose this action. They just do not want America to be dragged into another foreign war. It's going to hit particularly hard among military families whose loved ones are now fighting this conflict. And we've already seen several US casualties so far. But, you know, there's also some polling that show reasonably high numbers in support of some kind of action. You do tend to see a rallying around the flag effect, a bit of patriotism, a bit of cheerleading, admiration for what the US military is doing. Another complexity here is that there have been members of the Iranian diaspora in US cities taking to the streets, celebrating the downfall of the Ayatollah, in some cases even singing Trump's theme song YMCA. And so you've seen some of the politicians struggling with that dichotomy as well, that they are glad Khamenei is gone. They're not glad the way Trump went about it. And then one other thing I would say about the public reaction is just anecdotally, I'm hearing from various quarters, podcast hosts and online traffic that there's a surprising number of people who are not particularly engaged with this. It's far away. You know, it's obviously a gigantic story if you're in Washington and a lot of major cities. Others are perhaps not tuning in quite as avidly as we would imagine. And so politically, even this may not be as important, say, in the elections in November as the cost of living and daily bread and butter issues for Americans. Now, I think if the US death toll climbs significantly, when we get images of coffins draped in the Stars and Stripes coming home, if there's some kind of terrorist attack within the US, that dynamic could obviously change very quickly. But right now, I think that's another variable in the mix here.
How is Trump's base rationalizing and reacting to this, given this is a man who has said for many years that he is against these sorts of foreign interventions and ran on that?
That's right. I mean, if you go back even to 2016, Donald Trump had just been elected. He gave a speech in North Carolina, I think, where he explicitly said he opposes regime change being imposed by the U.S.
Our current strategy of nation building and regime change is a proven absolute failure. We have created the vacuums that allow terrorism to grow and thrive. I was an opponent of the Iraq war from the beginning.
And that's been a common thread of his political identity, this idea of America first and isolationism and not repeating the mistakes of past presidents with these forever wars. And many would argue he really betrayed that promise on Saturday. He was precisely unnecessarily dragging the US into another foreign conflict with very unforeseen consequences. And, you know, coming back to the voters could affect the cost of living for them with gas prices and so on. And therefore, you have certainly seen some voices in the Make America Great Again coalition speaking out, denouncing Trump's move, notably former Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who, of course, used to be a big Trump cheerleader and has turned against him over the Epstein files. She really pointed out the hypocrisy of Trump's promises and what's happening now. And there were others who did likewise, saying, you know, we did not vote for this and we'll never vote for Trump again. And he's betrayed the cause. But I think probably it's equally striking how many are not saying that. There are true MAGA supporters who are still very much on side with Donald Trump. And, you know, for example, Laura Loomer, a notorious social media person, she's been clashing with Marjorie Taylor Greene over this and others and very much cheerleading for Trump. And I think there's a couple of things going on there. One is that again, there are not US boots on the ground, at least for now. So these people can tell themselves, yeah, this is different from Afghanistan and Iraq. This is war being waged from thousands of feet in the air by planes, by missiles. Trump is not sucking us into that same kind of conflict. And it will be all over relatively soon, they hope and believe. And then secondly, I think never underestimate the fetish of military hardware, of explosions going off, of punching the air, chanting USA, USA. You know, look at our handsome military people doing this amazing stuff, and just the breathtaking nature of that spectacle of the military firepower. You know, some people fall in love with that and are awed by it. And you know, related to that is the fact that some of these supporters, it's always been about whatever Donald Trump says must be right and must be true, and they will completely contradict whatever views they had before if suddenly Trump is dictating them, because it is a strong cult of personality.
The Democrats are divided on this, which has really surprised me, because it feels like an easy argument to make when they're facing a president that's completely reversed position. Why are they struggling so much?
I think some of the same forces are in play there, that they do not want to be seen as siding with Ayatollah Khamenei, who was responsible for thousands of deaths just now, crushing protests. They don't want to be seen as sympathetic to a dictator. So you heard a lot of Democrats giving interviews with a kind of yes, but answer, sort of, yes, it's a positive thing. Yes, it's a good thing Khamenei is dead, but Trump went about it the wrong way. And some of them then get sucked into process arguments about he should have consulted Congress, you know, and they would say this is illegal and unconstitutional. Some of them will say quite fairly there's a real lack of medium to long-term strategy here. I mean, what's the end game for Trump? It's all very well removing this dictator, but who are you going to replace him with? How are you going to avoid a scenario, for example, reminiscent of Libya, where Gaddafi is ousted and then the place descends into chaos and division, and there could be a refugee crisis and so on. But I think, you know, Democrats are always worried about being accused of lacking patriotism, of you know, not being the party of the military. So that's caught them a bit. And certainly there are some more so-called centrist moderate Democrats who've already said they would not support a war powers resolution to restrain Trump. Again, I think they don't want to be seen as weak. Some of them have genuinely been hawkish on Iran for some time. They perhaps believe, even if he went about it the wrong way, Trump is onto something here, and they admire his boldness.
We'll be right back. You've painted a very complex picture of the landscape politically in America, but I can't let you go without talking about the relationship between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump, because, of course, this is a joint operation between the two. How much does it indicate about whether Netanyahu has been able to draw Donald Trump into this war? Some commentators have said that Netanyahu has taken the lead. I mean, has Donald Trump, in your view, has he been that impressionable? Is he following Netanyahu in?
Yeah, I think it's crucial, and future historians will write books about that, to what extent Netanyahu persuaded Trump to take on this war, and, you know, how did he do it? I mean, it's several chapters of that book will be devoted to the up and down relationship between the two men. The moments last year when Trump expressed dismay and frustration with Netanyahu, maybe for being too extreme or overreaching, thinking around the talks on Gaza. But, you know, Netanyahu visited the White House, I think, 6 or 7 times. He has huge pull. And I think, along with some of the Republican hawks, Netanyahu was absolutely instrumental in making that case to Trump that this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Following those protests we saw in the streets of Tehran and elsewhere, the Iranian regime has never been weaker. This is a chance to take them out. I suspect Netanyahu pushed some of Trump's buttons in terms of, you know, think how you'll be remembered by history. This is your chance to really leave a mark on the presidency, go down among the all-time greats, you know, not an also-ran president, but the ones who might be carved into Mount Rushmore. And we know with Trump's ego, his obsessions with things like the Nobel Peace Prize, that will have appealed to him. I think there's probably a few other factors in play. The fact that Obama struck that nuclear deal, Trump is obsessed with Obama and trying to outdo him. I think Trump also has mentioned that Iran tried to assassinate him a couple of times. I'm sure Netanyahu reminded him of that this is a chance to seek vengeance. And the very big picture is that, like so many US presidents before him, Trump finds in his second term, it's much easier to do foreign policy and make a difference. You know, domestically, it actually gets pretty boring for him, the minutiae of legislation in a very divided Congress, whereas he can bestride the global stage like a colossus and oust leaders and invade countries. And right now he really believes he's on a winning streak after what happened in Venezuela and then Iran on day one. I think one of the scariest things I heard today was a journalist who called Trump and interviewed him and came away with the impression Donald Trump feels that he's invincible right now. And, you know, what could be more dangerous than the most powerful man in the world with nuclear weapons believing himself to be invincible?
David, on that note, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
That was Washington Bureau Chief David Smith. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria, sound design and mixing by Joe Koning, and the executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. Don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to podcasts, including on Spotify. I'm Regid Ahmed. See you soon.